Once upon a midnight weary, artists of Iowa discovered something quite dreary. In a pandemic year, an evil villain is out to steal the holiday cheer.
No live entertainment? Get out! No way! I'll save it myself if I have to. I'll do it today.
Join Iowa Public Radio Studio 1 and XBK for The Holiday Special, an original musical for a pandemic year, at 7 p.m. on Sunday, December 20th.
This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. I'm Charity Nebbe. This month, we've been reading Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression by Mildred Armstrong Kalish. This is our final book club for 2020, and tomorrow here on Talk of Iowa, we will be revealing the list for 2021. Little Heathens takes readers back in time. It's a nonfiction account of what life was like on an Iowa farm during the years of the Great Depression, 1929 through 1933 and beyond into the mid-30s. Mildred Armstrong Kalish was born in 1922, so she experienced the Depression as a child. She was 85 years old when this book was published, but her memories from her early life are rich and detailed. And it's clear that she did a great deal of research to flesh out those memories. Here's just a short excerpt from the beginning of the book. My childhood came to a virtual halt when I was around 5 years old. That was when my grandfather banished my father from our lives forever for some transgression that was not to be disclosed to us children, though we overheard whispered references to bankruptcy, bootlegging, and jail time. His name was never again spoken in our presence. He just abruptly disappeared from our lives. The shame and disgrace that enveloped our family as a result of these events, along with the ensuing divorce, just about destroyed my mother. Is it possible today to make anyone understand the harsh judgment of such failures in the late 1920s? Throughout my entire life, whenever I was asked about my father, I always said he was dead. When he actually died, I never knew. So it was that Grandma and Grandpa chose to make our family of five, Mama, my 10-year-old brother Jack, my 8-year-old brother John, my 1-year-old sister Avis, and me, their responsibility. They decided to settle us on the smallest of Grandpa's four farms, which was located about 3 miles from the village of Garrison, where they had retired after a lifetime of farming. However, because the fierce blizzards and sub-zero temperatures of Iowa winters made it hazardous to walk to the one-room rural school we'd be attending, it had been arranged that we would live with Grandma and Grandpa in Garrison and attend school there from January until the school year ended in mid-May. At that time, our family would move out to the farm. Each year from then on, we went to school in the country from September until Christmas, then moved back to Garrison and finished the school year in town. Our new life began when we arrived at Grandma and Grandpa's on a cold winter day in February. The house we moved into that day was a large, substantial structure. It was located about 7 miles from Vinton, the seat of Benton County. Grandpa was born, raised, married, and buried all within an 8-mile radius of Garrison and Yankee Grove, the wooded area where his parents had settled as pioneers. That's from the beginning of Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression by Mildred Armstrong Kalish. A couple of expert readers will be joining the conversation in a few minutes, but to start us off, Pamela Riney Kerberg didn't live this history, but she's been studying it for a long time. She is a distinguished professor of history at Iowa State University. She has focused her research on agricultural and rural history, as well as the history of childhood and family. And Pamela, you were the very first person I thought of when we started talking about who to invite to be part of the book club. Hello.
Hello, Charity.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. And Pamela, tell me about when you first encountered this book.
I don't remember exactly how I first encountered it, but I became aware of it. It looked like something that would be of great interest to me, given my particular academic interests, personal interests. Picked it up, read it, and thought, wow, this is engaging. This is incredibly interesting. And I ended up assigning it to a couple of classes worth of students so that they could get a glimpse into this particular world that is, as you said, gone.
Well, And let's talk a little bit about that, because, of course, there are still farms in Iowa. Farm life is a very important part of the state. But this is a world that really is gone. Flesh that out for me.
Right. Well, there are so many things in this book that you simply don't see today, or if you do, it's in a somewhat different or very minor form. The fact that their father was completely banished from their lives and never spoken of again after this, whatever this particular embarrassment was, seems very strange to us today, that he simply disappeared from their lives. The fact that they were folded into this extended family so thoroughly, it often seems a little odd. The incredible shame that the mother felt, and the fact that she really became a recluse because of the embarrassment of whatever her husband had done and the divorce, is something that I think most young people today simply don't understand. The embarrassment people felt about human bodies that Kalish does such a good job of describing is, again, something that my students found utterly perplexing. The fact that every single, well, they did buy a few things for the kitchen, but the fact that every meal began with homemade ingredients and had to be made from scratch is incredibly alien to most young readers today. So there are so many elements of this story that are alien. That's one of the real charming things about this book.
Well, and can you help us put it in perspective also in the context of the Great Depression? You have done a lot of research about the Great Depression and about the Dust Bowl years. Iowa was not in the Dust Bowl. This family obviously has a lot of hardships. The Depression was hard for everyone, but the family is actually really well situated to get through the Depression, right?
That's right. She describes them as being very frugal. She talks about hardships and hard times. But the truth is that this family, this set of grandparents, owned a house in town, and they own 4 farms. Now, we don't know exactly how big those farms were, but they had to have been at least 80 acres apiece, I'm guessing. So they owned a significant amount of land. And yes, they were always worried about people being able to pay the rent so they could pay the taxes, because if they couldn't pay the taxes, they might lose the land. But they had far more resources than the average Iowa farm family would have had in this era. So as much as they were afraid, and I do not discount the fear of loss in any way, as much as they were afraid, they actually went into that decade in far better shape than the average Iowa family would have. There are heartrending photographs that the Farm Security Administration took in Iowa in the 1930s of, you know, of little children with no shoes and no food and, you know, really dreadful poverty. That's not what Kalish is talking about, but she's talking about the fear of that kind of poverty, which was very real for a lot of families.
Right, right. They were a family that was in a situation where they weren't going to starve to death. But of course, there was the real danger that they might lose a farm, for example.
That is right. Clearly, these folks aren't going to starve. And there were hungry people on farms in Iowa during the 1930s, but mostly in 34 and 36, when the drought on the Great Plains actually washed into the Midwest. Those were probably the worst years for families in Iowa. But, you know, most farm families in Iowa at least had chickens and a garden through most of this. So yes, times are very hard, but probably not starvation hard for families in that community, and particularly not for Kalish's grandparents and her extended family.
In the excerpt that I read just a few minutes ago, she talked about her childhood coming to a complete stop or a virtual stop when she was 5 years old, and these terrible things happened within her family unit. But and we will dig into childhood and also the work that she remembers doing and that her siblings did when she was growing up. But Pamela, help us put this in perspective, too, because you've done a great deal of research about childhood on the farm. And childhood was just so dramatically different than it is now. For Kalish and her siblings, childhood was brief, and they were expected to be real contributors to the family.
That's right. Farm children in that era lived in a world where work came first. Now, you know, she writes about going to school on a regular basis. Not all kids did. You had to get your chores done in the morning. You had chores in the evening. At times when there was a great deal of work to be done, you worked through the day. If you were not working out in the fields, you were expecting it to be helping in the garden. You were expected to be helping the mother inside the house. There was work to be done basically from the time that a child was old enough to grasp the concept that, you know, that you had to go out and pick up sticks to be used as kindling, or you needed to go out and gather eggs and bring them back into the house. There was work to be done by everybody. And, you know, and it varied by the time of the year, but really work was the central organizing element for children's lives.
And we learned
school
that
came second.
Right. We learned that Mildred herself started working as a hired girl when she was 13 years old. And we don't know what her brothers did when they turned 12 or 13. But the odds are pretty good that they also started being employed outside the home to bring an income into the family. So, Pamela, we need to take a short break here. We will be back in just a moment. We are talking about Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression by Mildred Armstrong Kalish. Pamela Riney Kerberg is here with me. She's a distinguished professor of history at Iowa State University and has focused her research on agricultural and rural history, as well as the history of childhood and family. We have a couple of other expert readers to bring into the conversation as well in a moment. And if you have something you'd like to add to the conversation, give us a call, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I know that this is a book that has resonated with many, many Iowa readers. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. We have been reading Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression by Mildred Armstrong Kalish. This is our final book club for 2020. And tomorrow on Talk of Iowa, we will be revealing the list for 2021. With me today is Pamela Riney Kerberg, distinguished professor of history at Iowa State University, and it's time to bring our other expert readers into the conversation. Tricia Hicks is here. She is a library resources tech with the State Library of Iowa, and when this book was published, she was a library director in Burt, Iowa, population 502, and she shared this book with many, many patrons at the library. Hello, Tricia.
Good morning.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. And take us back to when the book was published and you were sharing it with folks at the library. Tell me how people responded to it.
Yes, I was a brand new director at that library, and this was one of the first books that I would have purchased with library money. And as I read it, I knew that it was going to resonate with the people of our community. So beside putting it out on the shelf, I promoted it verbally, and it was constantly checked out. People shared it with one another in the town, and then they would have a waiting list of people that wanted to read it. So it connected very well with the community.
Well, and I can imagine, especially in rural Iowa, that a lot of the people who were reading the book were just a generation or two away from this experience. Is that something that you heard from some of your patrons?
Yes, I did. And I also connected with the book in ways of only being a generation away from the farm. So definitely the stories are connected all across the board.
So it's been about 13 years or so since you first read the book. And coming back to the book this time, was it different for you? Was there anything that struck you in a different way this time?
I believe so. I think because of what has happened in 2020, when I read the statement, and if you'll humor me, I'd like to read it. It
Sure.
was on page 19. She was talking about how her mother was very loose and very just made life kind of enjoyable because she had a loose rein over them when they lived with her in the city. But she understood that her mother had been through a great trauma. And so she said, "Mama's loose routines also made us kids remarkably flexible in handling unforeseen events as we grew up. If things don't go as planned, adapt to the new development and get on with your life." And so I think that attitude could do all of us in good stead for what we've been through in 2020. Things have not gone as we probably all planned.
Nope.
So we just kind of adapt and move forward. And then the other item that resonated with me in my second reading through is the fact that just 1 month ago, we did bury my own mother. And that was, I'm so thankful that the few weeks preceding her death, she died of cancer in November. The few weeks preceding her death, we were able to take some oral history, write some things down. When she would share a story, I would write it down. And I have that now. I have it to remember. I have it to pass on to my children. I even took some video coverage with my cell phone. And she had a lot of Iowa memories growing up in rural Garnavillo. And so this book resonated in the fact that we do need to record our history so that we can share it.
Yeah, I'm so sorry to hear about your mom. And you're actually planning on sharing this book with your dad, right?
Yes, I am. Absolutely. And maybe he's listening today. I hope he is.
Well, I hope so, too. I want to bring our next expert reader into the conversation as well. When she's at work, Lindsay Smith is surrounded by many of the same tools and artifacts that are described in the book, Little Heathens. She is director of collections, exhibits, and archives at Living History Farms. Hello, Lindsay.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And the book was new to you, so tell me about your impressions.
Oh, I just love it. As someone who spent their career in public history and formal history education, I'm always trying to figure out how to really connect the nuances of the past with today's public, today's museum visitors. And the stories that are told in Little Heathens, I know I'm going to be referencing the book a lot in the coming years. Her writing style just really yields itself well to the museum world, and how can we really bring that history to life? So I really saw the whole book as a very entertaining reference book. I'm planning on having it with lots of post-it notes and notes stuck into it on my desk forever, essentially.
Yeah, perfect.
So I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And that really resonates, Pamela, with what you were saying about it, too. And something you said to me when we first talked about the book is that this is a really thick history. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's thick description. She goes into the heart of little tiny moments and little tiny events that the average person might take for granted. And she gives us everything we might want to know about that little tiny event, that little tiny moment, and in such an entertaining way. And
right.
You come away going, wow, okay, I now know something I didn't know before.
Well, and I can imagine that maybe some of the intricate details might be maybe a little bit boring for some readers, but I really reveled in the details, and I was just kind of amazed by her incredible memory. Again, she was 85 years old when this book was published, and I'm sure she did a lot of research. She was an academic all her life. I'm sure she dug deep to dig up some of those details that maybe weren't in her brain. But I mean, Pamela, were you struck as much as I was by just the incredible detail of memory she was able to share?
It really was amazing and so incredibly useful. I had never realized before that in order to lower the temperature in a wood stove that you put cold water into the reservoir. Well, that makes perfect sense, but how would I know that? There's no way I would have known that otherwise. And having this kind of detail means that I can look at a wood stove with a new appreciation. I can look at the kind of meals her mother and grandmother cooked and she cooked with new appreciation, because now I know.
And right. Well, and that's incredibly useful. It's the kind of knowledge that no one would have thought to write down or share, because you just knew how to do it. It's the kind of thing you take for granted. I'm not going to, you know, write down how to dial a telephone, because everybody knows how to do that. It's just one of those things that's part of life. And I do want to dig into, with all of you talking about childhood, because although Pamela and I already talked about it a little bit, I mean, the descriptions of childhood and just how foreign this kind of childhood is to us, but also to our children, is pretty striking. And Lindsay, I know you had a lot of thoughts about that, and thinking about what the 8 and 9 year olds in this book were doing versus what the 8 year old in your household is up to.
Exactly. Whenever I read something of this genre or for this time period, I inevitably end my reading session feeling, I admit it, pretty cranky. And it's become a pattern with me, because I have 2 small children. And, you know, after reading a few chapters about life on the farm and personal responsibility, understanding that kids are just going to complete the task or eat the meal given to you with no questions asked, no matter how old you are, you know, I'll put the book down. I'll be thrown back into the real world. You know, I'll look around my house and the chore list that is not done, and I will just get cranky. So then I start thinking about stories that Mildred has shared, and I'm going to bestow them upon my children as though this is going to change anything. You know, Little Heathens to me really highlights how different life is from not just the 20th century farm to the 21st century American suburban existence, but even me as a kid, how different it was, you know, 30, 35 years ago from the farm life. We've been in this suburban kind of existence for quite a while. So my oldest is almost 8. And when the author talked about how everyone 8 and up knew how to catch and kill a chicken for dinner, I will spare you reading the excerpt of the details, but it's in there in all the detail. I, as a mom, you know, put that story in a little reference file in the back of my head to bring up later. So sure enough, the next time I put down the book and got grumpy about how the table wasn't cleared or whatever it was, I told my son this story, you know, complete with the momism, you know, 90 years ago, kids 8 and up had to do this farm chore, you know, and tale as old as time. And even after this annoying mom moment, my son just stopped off with this curt, "Well, I'm not 8 yet," because he has a few months left until he's 8. So I figured in a few months, I will use this story about how 8 year olds are supposed to prepare the chicken for dinner, and it will not sink in. And I tell this story not to, I don't want to throw my poor kid under the bus live on the air, you know, but I'm telling this story because I know a lot of parents who could relate to that, including my parents, I'm sure, back when I was a kid, that we can't even relate. You know, we can tell stories of how it used to be, but if it's not in front of us, how do we really instill that on our kids? How do we really get through to that? I don't know if it's a "you're so lucky now" kind of attitude or what. But just throughout the book, I just kept seeing these moments of just how different the expectations were on kids. But then what kids expected as well. They didn't expect to not do that work.
Well, and it's interesting because, you know, Pamela, earlier you mentioned there of course were terrible things about this life. There were wonderful things about this life. I feel like this childhood responsibility is kind of on, it's both. You know, I'm thrilled that my children don't have to work the kinds of jobs that these kids had to work, because it really robs them of a lot of the joys of childhood. And as I mentioned, childhood is so short for the kids in this book and for the kids of that time. But at the same time, yes, I would really like them to do a lot more and take a lot more responsibility. So, I mean, Pamela, there's a fine line there.
Well, there is. And, you know, on the one hand, all of that work had to have been terribly tedious and unpleasant. But on the other hand, there's this independence that all of them seem to have experienced that is incredibly powerful. And I'm thinking not so much in terms of their work, but in terms of their play and how when they left the house, they did so in a very independent way, which could get them into a lot of trouble, but they could also develop this sense of mastery. And I'm thinking about them taming those horses, and they could have been killed.
Yes, absolutely. They just sort of sneak off and start playing with these two young draft horses that no adult had worked with at all.
And by the time they're done, these horses will handle a rider on their back. They're very well trained. And the adults are completely mystified because they don't know this has happened.
and the kids never, ever tell, which I thought was also another really significant detail there. And Tricia, is there anything you'd like to add here? I mean, the image of small children preparing the head for making head cheese, that's the chore that keeps popping into my mind. But Tricia, is there anything you'd like to add?
Oh, I think the whole concept of the big kids versus the little kids, that was part of their dynamic as they were growing up. And so they divided themselves. And then they had that other concept of the country kid and the city kid. And I love that story where Wilfred, their cousin, I believe he was, he came and he was too good. He was from the city and he was too good to drink their milk. So,
yes.
Justified these children that the adults actually went to town and bought him bottled milk, and it actually made them a little bit jealous that he got special treatment that they didn't get. So I love this part where they were walking by a nest with him and they saw an egg that they knew was rotten. It was greenish. And so they convinced him that that egg was magical. And if he would pick it up and just bump it against the post, it would release the magic powers. And so he did that. And, of course, he was just covered with the putrid smell and all of that. And what I loved was that they did not get much discipline for that, even though there's other ways that they were disciplined for other events. That particular event, I think the adults realized that the city kid kind of had it coming to him. I love that part.
Well, and that was very interesting. She was always very clear to report the amount of punishment or lack thereof that they received for every infraction. And I mean, her memory is so incredibly strong, but that really seemed to be important because for those details to last that many decades, that must have been something that communicated a lot to her. And I mean, one of the things that we do see also is that the communication among family members is not particularly open. And so the kids had to figure a lot of stuff out for themselves. So Pamela, do you have thoughts about that?
I found the whole lack of communication very interesting. I think I was looking at the book again this morning, and the one that really struck me was that, you know, as an 11-year-old, she didn't understand the difference between puberty and pregnancy.
Right.
And that had to have just been, you know, for a young girl going through puberty and not knowing what was happening and not even communication from her mother about this, that just had to have been astonishing and horrible and difficult. But they just sort of took that lack of communication as a given. She, you know, they didn't communicate about the body and about personal matters in ways that we would expect parents to communicate with children.
Well, and there's a lot of eavesdropping. We don't have a lot of time to dig into it right now, but Lindsay, I know that the eavesdropping that Mildred reports doing as a child was something that really moved you. She really recreated those conversations between family members.
Oh, I love it. In the first part of the book, she talked about the Thanksgiving preparations. And she goes on about, you know, the weeks involved in preparing a homegrown and self-sufficient meal, and that is all amazing information. But then she gets to the day of, and she really wanted to convey what a bustling kitchen on Thanksgiving felt like. And of course, if you have all these women in a room, you're going to be having 6-7 conversations going on at one time. And my little dirty secret is the first time I read the book, I didn't read it. I do audiobooks. I'm an avid audiobook reader. And the way the reader presented this section of Thanksgiving conversations was just absolutely fabulous. One sentence.
Let's pick that up in just a moment. We are talking about the book Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression. And we will continue in a moment. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club, and it's our final Talk of Iowa Book Club for 2020. Tomorrow, tune in to Talk of Iowa, and we will reveal the list for 2021 so you can plan out your future reading adventures. This hour, we're talking about Little Heathens, Hard Times and High Spirits on an Iowa Farm During the Great Depression by Mildred Armstrong Kalish. And with me this hour, Pamela Riney-Kerberg. She is a distinguished professor of history at Iowa State University. Lindsay Smith is here. She is director of collections, exhibits, and archives at Living History Farms. And Tricia Hicks, library resources tech with the State Library of Iowa. And Lindsay, we were talking about these conversations that little Millie was listening in on at Thanksgiving, but at the dinner table, she was always paying attention to what the adults were saying. And of course, they were saying a lot of things that they shouldn't have said. A lot of it was unclear to her, although the meaning became clear many years later. And what was one of the parts that really resonated for you?
Well, it was just this overlap. And of course, you know, she's paraphrasing, but I'm also thinking that she was probably drawing on decades of Thanksgiving conversations like this as she was writing the book. But in a matter of a paragraph, and as I mentioned previously, that I had listened to it first, which just brought this extra vibrance to the section, she will mention these conversations. I'll read this really short excerpt that just go on top of each other, that really bring that bustling Thanksgiving home to life. So, you going to Melinda's funeral? Oh, I guess so. Put the cabbage salad and the apple salad on the table. Such a shame, leaving all those children. I love the print in your dress. Where did you get the material? The oldest one is almost 12, so she'll be a big help. J.C. Penney's, only 36 cents a yard. Oh, the serving spoons are already on the table. It goes on like this for a page and a half, and it just really set the scene. I felt like I was really in her house on Thanksgiving with all these women walking around stirring the gravy and talking about the farm. And I was wondering, you know, I read this shortly after Thanksgiving and this being such a unique Thanksgiving that perhaps that bustling scene felt hit me a little harder this year because of the pandemic, because we weren't able to have that in our own lives as much. But that was really the first time I just completely had to go back and reread and then re-listen to that scene because it just brought it to life.
Well, and if I remember correctly, one of the conversations that she overhears, you mentioned the funeral there, but is that the woman who died because she was trying to give herself an abortion because she had had so many children? Was that part? Or there was maybe there was another part in the book. It doesn't really matter where it was, but I mean, just the some of the little details hint at some of the large tragedies that people were living with during those difficult times too.
That yes, and going back story. To the discussion about bodies, there is a section later on in the book where they talk about all these euphemisms and turns of phrase about how to refer to someone who's pregnant and how they think about that, but no one ever really comes out and says it. So growing up, Mildred had to figure this out and what it meant on her own.
And Pamela, I think I heard you chiming in there.
Yes, that whole Thanksgiving story, the thing that just jars in all of that is that there is one of the women saying, and she used a lead pencil.
Yeah.
And so that's where you find out, if you're paying attention, that they're talking about a neighbor who died because of a self-induced abortion. And she circles back to that story again later in the book. And then I love how she circles back yet again near the very end of the book, where she's again eavesdropping when the public health nurse comes to visit the woman she's working for, who has six children that have been born one after another. And this tough-talking public health nurse walks in and, you know, hands the woman two condoms, never labels them that.
Right.
But she explains how they're used and tells this woman that she, you know, should be careful and this is what she can do. And the woman says, well, I want to leave that up to God. But the last sentence about the whole comment or the whole scene is, and they never had another baby. And so, you know, Mildred has been eavesdropping, and she now has this knowledge that even many adults in the community don't have. But she has it because she's been listening to the adult conversation that probably she wasn't meant to hear.
Yeah. Well, and Tricia, one of the things that I know struck you was obviously the family goes through some really difficult things, and they would have even if it wasn't the Great Depression. But of course, the Depression just really magnifies the hardships. And Tricia, you were struck by how talking about emotions, expressing emotions, was not something that it was okay for the adults to do.
She mentioned exactly that. She had never seen adults cry, and when she did see them cry, it was over her grandparents' brother and sister that lost their farm, they lost their livestock, they lost all of their equipment, all of it during the Great Depression. And so it was a very traumatic day for her to walk, I think it was into the kitchen, and all the adults were crying. She said it was so shocking, it just upset the stability of her world to see the adults cry. And later in the book, she mentions that even the children were expected to keep their emotions in check. It wasn't something that you just verbalized or something that you displayed to other people. So they remain very stoic, but she distinctly recalls that horrifying event of seeing adults cry.
Yeah. Well, and that strikes me as something that was and for some people still is an important part of culture here in Iowa, that kind of stoicism. And I think that, you know, on the plus side, it's thought of as an ability to withstand whatever comes your way. But of course, there are negatives about not being able to express yourself, not being able to ask for help when there's something wrong as well. I mean, Tricia, did that make you think a little bit more about some of the people that you knew growing up?
Yes. I mean, I tend to be more emotional, but members of our family are probably less so. But I think it's become more open as the years have gone by. Certainly with my mother's passing, just being there with our family and everybody being able to be together those last couple weeks of her life, particularly the last week, it was really a beautiful thing, and there was a lot of emotion shared that had not been possibly in the past. And just taking that time to be present. And I had the best advice, I think, that I ever got from one of my coworkers, and she had been with her mother as she was going through approaching death. And she said, Tricia, just be sure you take the time off and be there, because that gift of time is something that you will never get back. And so that reminds me of this book, that they really didn't have a lot of monetary things, but they had time for each other, and they were always there during the hard things, and they passed that time together during those hard times.
Yeah.
And so you cherish those. That's very special to me.
I want to shift the conversation and talk about one of the fascinating parts of the book. And there are just some terrifying details in this part. But she talks about medicine. And of course, you had to be near death to call a doctor at that day and age. Pamela, what struck you about her conversation about medicine?
I knew that people didn't call doctors, but the whole description of treating blood poisoning with Epsom salts, a razor blade, and peroxide, and some hot water, was stunning. Because, you know, of course, blood poisoning is something, you know, you'd immediately be whisked off to the doctor now. But
to the hospital.
To the hospital. That's right. But they had no money. So, you know, you soak the toe, you slice the toe open, you let out the pus, and you clean it up with peroxide. And she survived. She didn't lose the limb. But it is horrifying because she so easily could have died from that. And, you know, even if she had medical treatment, she could have died from that. Right. Because, of course, you know, we're 10 years from, well, not quite 10 years, from antibiotics. And so, you know, no matter what they did, there was a good chance that she wasn't going to survive that.
Well, and Tricia, I know you mentioned that hydrogen peroxide was the cure-all for everything.
Yes. Everything, mouth sores, canker sores, barbed wire, glass cuts, everything was used peroxide. And we even do that. I use peroxide for everything as well. So that really resonated.
Well, I was particularly horrified by the grandfather doing his own dental work and treating his teeth with carbolic acid when they were painful. That, oh my goodness. Lindsay, what struck you?
I just liked the footnote that she would throw in every so often that would say, you know, amazing that we never had no one had a tetanus shot, but also hardly anyone ever got any serious infections, but that she never quite mentioned what those were. So it kind of opens the door to, were there incidents that were a lot worse? Was there a kid across town who maybe didn't make the memoir? But what were those situations? It was just very interesting. They were very lucky. And I liked how the author didn't try to keep us in that nostalgic moment of look at all these home remedies. She was very clear in saying, you know, I would never do that today, or I can't believe we got out scot-free.
Right. Well, and when they visit the cemetery, she takes that as an opportunity to talk about how in her family, and she, I believe, is 98 now, so this longevity continues into this generation, but that in her family, you either died in childhood or lived a very long life into your 90s, but a lot of them never made it out of childhood. I mean, and Pamela, that was reality then. So many children died.
Right. Anywhere from birth to age 5 was when children were most susceptible and most likely to die. And you made it through that. And if a woman made it through her childbearing years, then you had a very good chance of living to be an old person. The reason why life expectancy looks so low for that era is that so many children never made it to their teen years.
Yeah. Well, and I want to talk about school as well. Of course, she went to a country school, as I read the excerpt minutes and minutes ago now. But she went to a country school until Christmas, and then they moved into town and lived with her grandparents, and they went to the town school through the darkest part of winter and then through the spring as well. And Bill is on the line in Des Moines, and Bill Sherman, I know you are a country school expert, but you had a chance to talk to Mildred Kalish about this?
Yes, and I did find her book, so I can. I talked to her April 9th in 2008, about 2 years after her book was published. She was in Des Moines and spoke, I think, down at the Hotel Savory. And the question I had for her, I wanted her to compare and contrast her experiences going to a one-room school and moving. moving to a graded school and going back and forth. And my question was, which school do you think was most beneficial, and where did you learn the most? And her comment was that she learned well in both schools, and that her country school experiences helped her when she moved into the graded school, and then she learned things in the graded school that helped her when she moved back to the one-room school. And as I recall, she seemed to feel that she had learned some things in the country school that had not been covered in the graded school in town. And as I recall, she explained that she could hear older children answering questions and talking about their curriculum while she was doing paperwork at her seat. But Mildred is the only person that I've encountered in 25 years that had that experience of going back and forth between a one-room school and a graded school and had positive things to say about the experience.
Oh, Bill, thank you so much for sharing that. And that is really fascinating. And unfortunately, we only have a couple of minutes left here. And very briefly, I would love to ask each one of you what you think you'll take away from the experience of reading this book. And Lindsay, I'll let you go first. What do you think will stay with you?
Well, I've long thought that the concept of the line, life was simpler back then, I think in many ways it is true, but this book is a great reminder that simpler does not mean easier. Life may have been simpler for them, but it was a lot harder and required a lot more work.
Yeah, for sure.
And that's going to probably be a big takeaway for me.
And a lecture for your kids. And Tricia,
exactly.
Tricia, what do you think you'll take with you?
I feel like I'll take away the continuing value of that era, and also how I've tried to incorporate it into our children's lives. Like, our children detasseled corn and worked in the soybean fields. A lot of those Iowa things, we still do the cemetery picnics that she mentioned at the Jolly Ridge Cemetery. There's just a number of things that still I'll carry forward in the future with me.
And Pamela, you get the final word. What do you think you'll carry with you?
Well, it's kind of hard to boil it down to one thing, but I think it's that really the past is a foreign country, and that anybody reading this book now is going to be transported into a world that bears only surface resemblance to the world we live in now. And as a historian, you tend to think, oh, you know, 90 years ago wasn't so long. But when you think about everything that's changed in the interim, it was that long. And it was a different world. And her words can take us back to that place.
Yeah. And definitely worth spending some time with. Pamela, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, you are very welcome.
Pamela Riney-Kerberg is Distinguished Professor of History at Iowa State University. Tricia Hicks, thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Tricia Hicks of the State Library of Iowa. And Lindsay Smith, thank you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Lindsay Smith of Living History Farms. And be sure to tune in tomorrow to Talk of Iowa to find out what we're going to be reading on the Talk of Iowa Book Club in 2021. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbie.